I will start. My name is Amy Kalmanowski, and I am a professor of Bible here at JTS.
I'm Michael Unger from Columbus, Ohio.
And we've met many times, but...
You're my son. And
I know.
My daughter, your son, yes.
So nobody has to give all their connections to me, but, you know, that can happen afterwards. And there probably are a number, but yes, and Dina.
Dina Chardell, White Plains, New York.
Joanna Cantor, Phoenix, Arizona.
J.B. Sachs, Woodland Hills, California.
Joel Alter, New York, New York.
Gordon Tucker, White Plains, New York.
Ben
Schwartzberg,
Roswell
Lake,
New York.
Johnny Gaffin,
New York City.
Ravine Tillis, Merrick, New York.
Jesse Olinsky, South Orange, New Jersey.
Matt Fetterman, Cedarhurst, New York.
Gideon Estes, Houston, Texas. Yeah.
Marian Schulowitz, New York City.
Amy Roth, I work in Great Neck, New York.
Judah Cogan, Staten Island, New York.
Lee Pascal, Peekskill, New York.
Marlon Chari, Britain.
Deborah Zucker, Peabody, Massachusetts.
Hey, Nicole. Okay, so it's great to have the opportunity to learn with you today and to celebrate. We are actually celebrating 30 years of women in the conservative rabbinate, so I certainly celebrate that. And in many ways, what I'm actually, I also am excited because I'm going to be sharing with you, oh, look, it's wonderful. All these old friends. It's so great. I'm sharing with you actually a new project that I am working on now. So it's always a treat for me to have the opportunity to teach when the ideas are still in formation, not only because it helps me, frankly, articulate my ideas. So if they seem a little half-baked, they hopefully will become more baked over time. But also because I really do feel that when I teach, I learn, as we all do, you all are teachers, and that working through this material together is really important for me. And so I'm going to, you know, I'm going to present a framework that we're going to be looking at a text that I have a feeling is, certainly really is truly one of the most magnificent texts in the entire Tanakh. It is probably a relatively familiar text to all of you from the Haftarah. You may have it memorized or not. It's okay. I'm not going to test you. But I'm hoping, I always like to say I have the distinct advantage and disadvantage of teaching material that is actually quite familiar. And so that's wonderful because it means that we can really engage in the conversation, all of us. On the other hand, it's challenging for me because I certainly want to say something that you, I would like, I hope that you walk away looking at this material in a new way, which is sort of my personal challenge. And I hope that's what we're going to be able to do today. So the project that I'm working on is actually very much in line with our celebration of the 30 years of women in the conservative rabbinate. I've started to work on a book that I'm calling at this point Gender Bending in the Hebrew Bible, looking at narratives that defy the gender norms of the Bible, and sort of putting these narratives together to sort of ask in what ways do these narratives, are there consistent ways that these narratives actually defy those norms? And we're going to talk about what that is in a minute. And also to sort of think beyond that to say, you know, as we're going to see, there are a number of stories that do fit into this framework of stories that seem to defy the norms of gender in the Bible. And given the number of those stories, is there some reason that we can say the Bible sort of incorporates this story, these stories? What is it doing with all these sort of gender-defying stories? So before we unpack what I mean, and I'm going to be a little more specific about the lens through which I'm looking at this material, I want to just begin with two basic assumptions that I have about biblical text in general and about gender in the Bible. First of all, I want to say that one of my basic assumptions is that gender very much defines the world of the Bible. It is very much a world that is invested in distinct gender behavior. Right? In the Bible, it's very, and we can talk more about what precisely this means, but it's a world in which it is very invested in men behaving like men and women behaving like women. And when that doesn't happen, it causes a great deal of anxiety. And you can see that both in narratives as well as within the legal material. So a basic assumption I have is that the Bible's world is an extremely gender-defined world. That's assumption number one. And assumption number two is that the Bible not only is invested in a kind of gender-distinct world, but that it's also invested in a gender hierarchy, in which men are put in a position of privilege. And, you know, this is actually in my world, which one could label as being sort of feminist biblical scholarship. The question or not whether or not the Bible should be considered to be a patriarchal text is actually, believe it or not, a live question on the table. I actually fall down in the category of saying it is, right? I think it is a patriarchal text. But some people would quibble with that, but I think nobody would quibble with the fact that I think the Bible certainly seems to uphold a hierarchy, I would say a social and a religious and a political hierarchy that privileges men over women. Okay, so these are sort of my two basic assumptions. The Bible is invested in gender-defined behaviors, and the Bible is also invested in a kind of gender hierarchy which privileges men over women. Right? Given those two assumptions, I want to begin by asking, as I said, I'm sort of looking at narratives that defy the gender norms, that sort of seem to, in essence, go against the assumptions that I just made that are in the Bible. So before I sort of list them for you, I'm just curious. Can you think of any narratives that sort of go against the assumptions that I just made? So the obvious, usually the very first narrative that anyone would ever say would be the Yael and Devorah narrative, which in some ways I always like to say is the narrative. I mean, one of the other things that I in some ways attempt to prove in many ways in this project is that the Bible actually thinks and uses gender intentionally. And if there is ever a narrative, I think the one that we're going to be looking at today is another narrative like that. But if there is ever a narrative that you would say that the Bible is playing with gender and its gender norms, one would have to say that Yael and Devorah is probably the first one that comes to mind, right? But there are others. Anything else?
Maybe Rahav?
Rahav, it could be another one, certainly.
Yeah. Judah and Tamar.
Playing with gender norms and how so?
She takes the initiative when she...
So she takes the sexual initiative right. In that narrative. Okay.
Also, he admits that she's right.
Okay. Now, you know, I want to be somewhat... I mean, it's interesting. You don't want to say that if ever a woman sort of shows power, you know, or is proven right, that that's necessarily, you know, sort of overturn... It may be overturning the norms. But, so you have to be a little bit careful about that. But it is interesting to think... I mean, Yehuda and Tamar is the sexual aggressor for sure.
Ritzpah.
Challenging
David,
another one. It's a great narrative and not ending in the best possible way.
Abigail. Esther only saves the day after Mordecai does everything she commands him to.
Okay. Good. Others that people can think of?
I would just flip that gender, the gender norms of the Bible, to also say that prior to that, Mordecai is playing this sort of gender stereotype in the female role that's typically reserved females in the Bible prior to Esther taking the gender stereotypical male role. Mm-hmm.
How about Yitzchak is trying to negotiate with God, and then it fails, and so it says Rivka went off and batelet the drosha.
So actually, I have to say, in some ways, this whole project began with me trying to kind of address Yitzchak and Rivka, which I think in some ways is the most gender-defining relationship in the entire Torah, and in some ways is where I am trying to basically say, what is it doing there, right? I mean, all of these have elements of this in some ways where you have a kind of inversion. You know, you have either the proactive female, the sexually aggressive female, the sort of more righteous female, however we want to understand that. Any other just quick other ones that want to pull on the table?
The control issue after the mandrakes, where it's Leah and Rachel deciding who he's going to sleep with that night, and they're in control of the sexual characters.
Right. And so that's another great example of that. Any other, I mean, just quickly?
Ruth.
So Ruth always, you know, Ruth in the sense of how does it invert? Because you could say the Boaz
she
in the end.
She sort of takes charge of the Boaz situation, right? And goes to him to seek out and propose marriage.
Oh, except Naomi's really cool.
Yeah,
so.
Right.
So,
maybe.
Right. I mean, I actually think that there is certainly, I mean, in some ways, what makes Ruth the kind of most interesting, I mean, and I do think, I mean, as I said, in some ways, the most gender subversive relationship is Rivka and Yitzchak. I think in some ways the most challenging gender text is Ruth, which is sort of, you know, is an interesting text. So obviously, one more.
And it's interesting that this is the Haftarah that goes with Vayera, with the Akedah story.
Excellent.
Hagar, and my 20 daughters love it. So, because Hagar and Sarah were such, I don't know, they Sarah was absent from the Akedah story, and then she pushed Hagar out, so you don't know the story. But it's...
Okay, so, and in fact, bringing, you know, one of the things that makes this particular text so rewarding to read is, in fact, to see the intertext within it, and to hear the, and I think that this is, in some ways, meant to be read, obviously. I mean, I think even within the context of the Torah, this is a text that's meant to be read in the context of the Akedah, and I think in some ways a gender lens is the best way into this. So, obviously, there are a number of narratives that one could say, you know, would fit into this category of gender bending. And I'm really, in some ways, using this term somewhat descriptively. And I wanted, so I'm going to lay out my kind of thesis for how I'm, you know, what I'm thinking about how these stories work together. And then I want to sort of play it out by looking at one particular text. So, you know, I identify, actually, many of the stories that you have already identified, I also identify as part of this project, a number of stories that I would say fit into this category of gender bending stories. And I want to be clear, I'm actually, you know, what I do in this project is I'm not offering, in my language, sort of contemporary biblical scholarship, what I don't offer is a kind of queer reading of these texts, right? My reading of these texts is not saying that these narratives that exist in the Tanakh that defy, you know, the gender norms are there to kind of pull apart the gender binary and offer us a different alternative, right, of a world in which men are not behaving like men and women are not behaving like women. I don't think that at all. As I said, I think that the Bible is deeply, deeply invested in a gender-defined universe. And I actually want to argue that these stories, these gender-bending stories, are in many ways there to kind of ensure that those norms continue. In some ways, I'm going to read these stories as kind of destabilizing stories that kind of, you know, in some ways disturb in order ultimately to come back and realign the world according to the typical gender norms. Right? I want to say that these narratives, even though they in some ways seem to invert the gender hierarchy, and as this one, as we're going to see very clearly, have a woman in a position of privilege, and actually by doing so kind of in some ways put the man in a, and the man in this case, of course, is an Ish Elohim, who happens, you know, is a prophet, who happens to be Elisha, in a very compromised position in the context of this narrative. But that ultimately, what I want to say this story is there, is about, is it puts him in that compromised position, it shakes things up, but ultimately it works to secure the norms that put him back into his position of privilege. All right? I want to argue, as I said, and this is the second piece to the thesis that I have, it, the Bible is definitely invested in a social hierarchy that privileges in its men. But I want to suggest, too, that that social hierarchy is very much connected to a religious hierarchy. And this is sort of the real, in some ways, thesis that I'm working with. The Bible is invested in women being subservient to men and protecting that hierarchy, because I believe that the Bible is invested in protecting masculinity, because whose masculinity does the Bible ultimately want to protect over everyone else's? God's. Above and beyond. All right? And so in some ways, and this is to me really, this is deeply disturbing to get this, and at the same time, you know, I think very illuminating, right? So in some ways, the ways that women behave like men are paradigmatic of the way men need to behave to God. So that the Israel-God relationship is mirrored off of the male-female relationship. So you protect that social hierarchy in order to protect the religious hierarchy. In order, is this disturbing?
No, just thinking, so can men be rabbis too, or only women?
So here's where I go. We're now, but here's where I go. Oh my goodness. Right. So here's where I go. This is why, so here's where I ultimately go. All right, everyone with me so far, because that's actually where I'm ultimately. So the ideal Israel, right, the ideal religious man in the Bible, in my reading, is a feminized man. Right, is a man that actually is somewhat compromised, you know, again, by the in the context of the Bible, sort of feminized, compromised, in order to be in relationship with God. So who is an ideal compromised, feminized man in the Bible?
Joseph.
Joseph is certainly one of them. But what did I say is my major?
Isaac.
Right? Is that Isaac ultimately, you know, I mean, I'm not doing Isaac today. I could do Isaac with you another time. But to me, Isaac in some ways is, you know, the Bible's sort of most pure religious persona. That's what I would argue. Because he's a submissive, right, feminized male figure that knows how to be in relationship to God, right? And part of the destabilizing thing, as we're going to see in this particular narrative, the danger is, right, so if the danger, of course, is if you upend the social hierarchy, that's dangerous because you need to have that social hierarchy in place so that you can learn how to be, you know, to have a religious hierarchy. So, for instance, what's the narrative in the Bible that inverts the social hierarchy more than anything else? What's the first narrative in the Bible?
Adam.
So Adam and Eve is a perfect example of sort of the first human relationship. The first narrative that you have is really about an inverted social hierarchy that threatens the relationship that you have with God. And ultimately what has to happen? Ultimately, you have to, you know, you have to make sure that that social hierarchy is firmly in place. And so the curses that you have there ensure that that happens. And then the narrative can go forward, right? So, you know, there's a real danger in if you ever have, you know, with that social hierarchy, if you ever have a woman commanding, or that's where the Judah and Tamar is an interesting example, right? That's a threatening situation. Right? So that's one threatening situation. Another threatening situation, and that's what we're dealing with here, is when a man, frankly, gets too uppity. And when a man of God begins to behave too much like a god, and then needs to be put back into place through a woman. Right? And that's a second threatening thing, because the man of God, the Ish Elohim, the Yitzhak, the prophetic figure, has to know how to exist, how to be submissive to God. If ever a human being exceeds those limitations, that human being needs to be pulled back into place. I mean,
yeah. I just want to make sure I understand the parameters when you talk about hierarchy. You're suggesting that hierarchy means at the top of the hierarchy are the ones who are the decision makers, right? That's what you mean by hierarchy?
Yeah, have control, power, authority.
Okay. All right. Because, you know, I just think about a lot of the women make decisions, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're at the top of the hierarchy. I mean, you can have, a president who's just, you know, a figurehead, and it's through him that, you know, there's great, you know...
Right, and there's also women that exert... Right, and there's women that exert power within, you know, one could say, you know, their properly defined social roles. And that's why you have to be somewhat careful with including... I mean, that's why someone like an Esther is a complicated figure. I don't actually think... I mean, in my reading, I don't actually think that Esther is such a gender bender. I think that she remains, you know, within her kind of feminized rubric, even though she exerts a certain power.
Okay.
All right? So the narrative that I want to look at is one of these narratives that I think, you know, you really see this dynamic play out. What I want to argue for is that you have an Ish Elohim, a man of God, that essentially oversteps his boundaries. And it takes an Isha Gedola, a great woman, to put him back in his place. And that by the end of this narrative, you see, you know, the beginning part of this narrative, you really see a gender inversion. And by the end of the narrative, you see the realignment and you see the proper gender hierarchy very much evident. So I just want to, you know, I mean, I know that we're going to end up running out of time, and I know this is somewhat familiar, so I just want to kind of read through the text together and do a close reading as we go through. Given the lens that I've seen, I think you will see it already differently from the very beginning, paying attention to the gender dynamic. But the other thing that I very much want us to pay attention to are the intertexts. This is one of the most well-written, and I would say highly literary texts in the entire Tanakh. It is an extremely intentionally constructed text. So there are no unintentional details, not that there ever are, but this is a particular text where if you think you notice something, you probably do, and it's worth putting it on the table. All right? So let's just see where we are, and we'll open it up. So I'm going to read through the first, this is beginning in chapter 4, verse 8. I'm going to read through the first three psukim and translate them. And then you throw out on the table, given gender dynamic or just details that strike you as interesting. So, Vayi Hayom, V'yavor Elisha El Shunem, V'sham Isha Gedola, V'tachazek Bo Le'echol Lechem, V'yhi Midei Avro, Yasur Shama Le'echol Lechem, V'tomar El Isha, Hinei Na Yadati, Ki Ish Elohim Kadosh Hu, Over Aleinu Tamid, Naaseh Na Aliyat Kir Ketana, ונשים לו שם מיטה ושולחן וכיסא מנורה. והיה בבואו אלינו יסור שמה. So it used to be that Elisha, doing his prophetic rounds, would pass through Shunem, and there was a great woman, and she grabbed hold of him to feed him bread. Every time that he would pass by, she would grab hold of him to feed him bread. And she says to her husband, I know that this is a holy man of God who passes by us frequently. Let us make for him a small upper chamber, and let us place in there a bed, a table, a chair, a light, and every time he's going to pass by, he's going to turn there. All right? So you tell me from the very beginning, in terms of hints that you see in terms of gender dynamic, but other kinds of narrative details that strike you as interesting from the beginning.
Well, the word v'tachazek bo.
And why is that interesting?
The use of chazak, the notion of clinging onto the prophet, like grabbing the robe in a sense.
And in what sense do you mean?
Taking leadership.
Okay, I thought you were going to be a little bit more graphic than that, because I am. We're going to get there.
Well, on that, the hechazak tabo at the end of Vayikra is about someone sustaining, supporting someone who has kiyamuch achicha, the hechazak tabo. So she is the one who is taking care of someone who's without means. Mm-hmm.
That's lovely. Mm-hmm. That actually I hadn't thought of before, putting it in that perspective. I mean, I definitely think, I mean, chazak is, I mean, it's obviously a very strong verb, right? Literally, to grab hold of. And I think it's important to hear it in its other contexts. Certainly, even in this narrative.
The point is, with Bo, it's an idiom that we already have.
Right. Yeah. And, as we're going to see later on, just so you see where I'm going ultimately, which is where I was going to say with this, in verse 27, she's going to do it again. And in this case, she's going to betachazek raglav, right? Which I'm going to read is actually, we're going to see what, in fact, she's holding on to there. But I would say, whatever we want to understand, it's true. There does seem to be, I mean, clearly in terms of a dynamic, she's certainly reaching out to him, right? And she's certainly, the main actor. And I think that verb also, is very, it sort of conveys that. Chazak also, by the way, and we don't want to go into the totally dark and negative, but of course, chazak does come in several contexts, in the context of rape narratives. So grabbing hold of, you know, whether it's a violent act, you know, certainly a forceful act. It can be a forceful act for good, but it certainly is a forceful act, and that's what I want to hear. So very good. Other things you notice?
Well, the husband seems to be very downplayed in relationship to her. She seems to be the one who is the controlling agent. The household who makes the suggestion to renovate the house so that the prophet could stay there.
Okay. So number one, you notice that she's married, right? So that's always an important thing and always interesting because, you know, to notice that. And, of course, her husband, as you all know, plays a secondary role, a very interesting and I would say almost absent role in this narrative that is actually, you know, very interesting. But again, clear, you know, I would say here you do have what appears to be an inverted gender role where he does seem to be listening to her. She certainly seems to be the force in the house, right? And we're going to see that play out even more so, right? Other details that you notice about her?
Well, about her, but about the story. I don't know that I have textual support for this, but it just occurred to me she's making a special chamber for him. It just felt like she's creating a holy space.
So this is what we have to talk about, right? So the fact that we have such detail here is always very striking, right? The Bible does not, you all know this, right? The Bible does not sort of, you know, layer in a lot of details unless it's useful. So the fact that we have such specificity with what she does. So I want us to think about that. What precisely is she building for him? The fact that she says, na'aseh, let us create, so that should be evocative to us, right? Again, in hearing what she's doing, right? The fact that she's making an upper chamber, but upper chamber, aliyah, kir,
kitana
is interesting.
She's gedolah.
She's gedolah. So I'm actually surprised that we didn't start there. I'm really surprised about that, right? Because that's in some ways the most, sort of striking that we have to do that. So those are details, and I think you're going where I want us to go, which is that she's clearly creating, I think, a specific kind of space, and I think that the language of holy space for the holy man is actually kind of there. Because what other structure do you know has a menorah, a kiseh, a shulchan, right? Now, the mitah is actually the kind of curious thing. The mitah, and I think this is overreading, but as long as I say I'm overreading, it's okay. I mean, this is not me overreading it, right? I actually believe that. Somebody had said that, I mean, all of these have parallels, obviously, to the mishkan. So I think that she is constructing a mini mishkan. Right? Which I have to tell you is remarkable, right? And na'aseh. So this woman is constructing a mini mishkan. The mitah, someone has actually suggested, you know, is going to function as a kind of altar because, of course, the mitah is where where we're heading, right? Is where the body of the boy is going to be. And ultimately where the body is going to be revived. So maybe. You know, I think in order to do that, you need more of a linguistic connection for that, but I offer it to you. But just to think of one,
What do you think of the fact that she doesn't have a name?
So this is what I want to say. So this gets us back to the Isha Gedolah. So first of all, you should know that this is the only place in the entire Tanakh that a woman is given this adjective as being a great woman. So now, to say that, I know that for a fact, but I'm not sure how often a man is given gadol. So I need to do a concordance look on that. So somebody, you can look that up. We should know it. But so typically, right, you know, very often people have a kind of, you know, knee-jerk response to say that when a woman is unnamed, right, that is an indicator of a kind of lowering of status. And it may be. I mean, it's always, always interesting to notice when characters are named and not named. It's actually always interesting. So when characters are central like this. So, you know, it may be a diminishment in some ways, but I don't see it that way. I feel that what we have here is that it puts her as a kind of clear narrative counterpart to the Ish Elohim. And I would say this is where, again, part of what I'm arguing for is that gender, you know, the Bible is intentionally playing with gender. So it's presenting you with an Isha Gedolah and an Ish Elohim. And the fact that it's a great woman and a holy man, it's leveling them. And in some ways is putting them as clear narrative counterparts. Now, Elisha, obviously, let me just continue a little bit because otherwise we're... Elisha obviously does have a name. Though one of the most interesting things about the way this narrative, you know, plays out is that he's really not named. He's mostly referred to as an Ish Elohim in the context of this narrative. So even his name is somewhat removed. The other thing you have to pull onto the table, obviously the Akedah is on the table. Why is obviously the Akedah on the table from the very beginning?
It's the Haftorah.
Well, beyond that.
Because he's supposed to be born Kayat.
That we're going to get. We're not there yet. We're not there yet.
From his parents.
We're going to get all there. I'm talking about from the Pesukim I just read.
She has no children.
We're going to, all of that is sort of, I'm talking even just the language. So, for instance, in Breishit, in 22:12, right, when Avram is about to kill the kid and is told not to, we have Vayomer, Al Tishlach Yadcha El Hana'ar, Va'al Ta'aslo Me'uma, Ki Ata Yadati, Ki Yirei Elohim Ata. Right? So you have very similar language. And I think that the other things are there, right? I think that the other things are there. But to me, and you know, to sort of see this, I mean, obviously there are real connections here, right? To the Akedah, just on the basic level of a child in distress. But to me, the similarities are less interesting than the differences. And in some ways, this narrative begins where the Akedah ends. The Akedah ends with a revelation. Oh, now I know. Right? Now God has learned something. I now know that you are God-fearing to Avraham. This narrative begins already with her in the knowledge that what we have here, right, is a sacred, you know, is a sanctified person. She begins in that place. Right, she already knows that. But obviously the major difference in this, right, when you think about how the two stories are working in conversation with each other, right? So what is the Akedah effectively a story about? It's a story about a father, you know, actively, hurriedly going to kill his son. Right? What is the story of this story ultimately about? A mother actively going to save her son. So from the very beginning, you know, these stories are in deep conversation with each other. So I want to get back to just one second, because, yes, what's her...
She's also called something else besides Isha Gedolah.
Mm-hmm.
Gehazi, not Elisha, refers to her as Hashuna Mihalaz.
Right.
Which I would assume is rather taking her down a peg.
So we're going to Gehazi, okay. So Gehazi, we're going to talk about, because I think he does, in some ways, you know, run some friction in here. So just, I'm going to move on, and we can look at that now. So already we see her, you know, we see her power, we see her, you know, holding, you know, being the one that's aggressive is not the quite right word. We see her able to ascertain the situation, see the depth of it. She's the one who's actively building this. She even sounds a little bit like God, right? Naaseh. Right, let me create. And then she constructs this holy site. So the question of what she's actually doing, right? Why is she constructing this place for Elisha is a really live question. Why would she do this? What do you think she could possibly want?
Philanthropist.
She's just doing this for kindness, right? So, you know, or she's doing it for something else. Right. Either she's doing, I mean, to me, there's two possibilities here. Right. Either she's kind and she's just providing respite to him, or she's selfish and she wants something that he can offer.
She doesn't ask for a child.
We're going to get there.
But she obviously anticipates.
Well, I don't agree with that. So let's see what she actually wants. What I actually want to suggest, and this is the bottom line, is that that's not what she wants. What she wants is to sort of harness his religious power. She wants to be in that presence of that religious power. She wants to manage it to her own advantage. He misreads that. He makes a very gendered assumption. he's going to overstep his boundaries, right, by, you know, promising or something that he should not have done because it's only in God's capability of doing that. And he's going to have to be corrected. Now, who manages the divine presence? The priests. So, to a certain extent, do we have a female figure that is in some ways functioning, right? The closest we have to a narrative of a woman who is somehow functioning in that kind of priestly role. Right, but let's go on a little bit now, see. It's good, no?
Yes?
Yeah. All right.
It's always good.
Yeah. All right, so let's go on a little bit further. Now the story, the plot thickens. Okay, so... This is Hazot. Okay, so I want to hear what you said. I mean, I said it obviously, so we would say right. But you know, so he would go, and he took advantage of spending the night at her, you know, in her chamber. And so Elisha calls to Gehazi, and he says, you know, call this Shunammite. And I think you are supposed to hear Hazot, right? I mean, we have other situations like that in the Torah. That's a distancing, right? You know, this Shunammite. And she comes, and ta'amod lefanav. So why is standing before, right, sort of significant language?
Subservience.
Who said subservience? Yeah. So clearly subservience, right? And, well, frankly, you have significant figures, like when Moshe stands before God, and when Abraham stands before God, say famously, like when he argues on behalf of the righteous, right, before Sodom and Gomorrah are being destroyed. Amad lifnei, right, what you do when you stand before, right? It shows, and again, it could be just simply, I mean, you know, a gesture of subservience, but whether she is in some ways, you know, showing a reverence for, you know, I would say that this is showing clearly her reverence for him.
But right? He's just still not talking to her even when she's standing before him.
Absolutely. And one of the dynamics that you see play out in the context of this narrative, and ultimately I'm going to show you where this is. First of all, so I can say this to us, right? Ultimately, so I can say this, she's going to grab him by the... Right? And she's going to make him talk to her. But it's not easy. And everything that he's going to, you know, he is not there. So he's assuming distance, and he's not seeing her for who she is. And again, you know, hine na yadati, she sees him for who he is. He cannot see her for who she is.
Should we make anything out of the ambiguity of the reference of the word lefanav in Yud Bet? Right? Is lefanav Gehazi or is lefanav?
That's great.
Elisha.
I would say it's got to be Elisha. I mean, in my reading, it would make more. I mean, yes, it's ambiguous. In my reading, it would have to be. You know, I want it to be Elisha.
Right. He has had his servant bring her to him, and because Gehazi is not the powerful figure here, yes, it makes sense that
right.
It's Elisha, but in fact the text is ambiguous.
So again, to make it work...
Or maybe it's my misreading. Maybe it's only because I don't understand that.
No. I mean, I think you can. I think that the narrative logic would be Elisha, because, you know, why would she go before Gehazi? But also because, I want to say, she has, like, you know, what's the word? Tunnel vision.
Yeah.
She knows what she wants.
Right.
So let's keep going, because now we're going to get into the other, you know, Isaac allusions here. So verse 13, Mayomer lo amor na eleha hine charadit aleinu et kol hacharada hazot. Right. So more revelatory language. Right. You've shown us all your, you know, all your reverence, all this reverence. So mela sot lach. What can we do for you? Hayesh ledaber lach el hamelech o el sar hatzava. Matomer. This I'm going to give you my chiddush on this one. Matomer betoch ami anochi yoshavet. So the question is asked, you know, okay, what can we do? Can we give you help with the king? Can we give you political help? And then she answers, you know what?
I'm the king of my home.
Well, It's a completely vague answer, so we have to kind of figure out what she says. She says, I mean, literally, you know, I dwell among my people. But the first thing you have to ask, again, clueless Elisha, right? Clueless Elisha, why? Because what does he offer her?
Political.
What does he not offer her?
Spiritual.
Nothing religious. Now, one thing I meant to say about the Gedolah is in terms of translation, you know, not sure if it means wealth or if it means status, right? You know, or both, obviously, both come hand in hand. She clearly is a woman of means, right? But we're not going to get to the coda, but you have it. I mean, you all know it, you know, where she actually does seem to have an audience with the king. It's clear that she has political power. So offering her that is nonsense, right? It's stuff and nonsense. So again, I want to say he's missing the mark and not seeing her for what she wants, right? Now, her question, and I think she tells him this, and this is my chiddush, and you don't have to buy it, but this question of how to understand betoch ami anochi yoshavet. You know, I'm dwelling, you know, whether we say I dwell comfortably, I don't need anything. I do a come. I mean, that's how it's usually. I don't know how it's translated, but that's usually how it's understood, right? So my chiddush, and maybe again, this is over reading, but I hear in this actually a line from Isaiah, from Yeshayahu 6, right? From his moment of revelation, from when he sees his temple vision, right? Kadosh, 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 Adonai Tzevaot. That's that chapter. In fact, we just had Kadosh, 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 Adonai Tzevaot, Melech HaLaretz Kevodo, right? And everything trembles. And what does Isaiah say in response in verse 5? He says, this is 6:5, V'omar, oily ki nidmeti, I'm undone, ki ish temeh sfatayim anochi, I'm a man of impure lips. What does he say? Uvbetoch am tmei sefatayim anochi yoshev. Similar language, right? But what is Isaiah concerned about? Isaiah wants to commune with God, right? He's saying, I'm impure. You need to help me out so I can better commune with God. So I want to suggest reading that, and again, this is me, so you don't, you know, I'll be curious, you can push back. But I would suggest that in this moment, she's making it very clear what she does not need and what she wants. I'm politically fine. I want something more than that. I brought you into my house to manage your holiness, and I want to gain some of that. And she might even want to say, and I'm going to suggest this a little bit, that she might even want a little bit of that status herself. Right? I want a little of your holiness. I want to be able to, you know, maybe I want to be, you know, in Isha Elohim, if such a thing exists.
Can I just ask you, Hamelach, you wouldn't read that as Hamelach or Kadosh, as God? I mean, it's strictly in a political context.
Oh, back here?
I know the English, it has a small case.
No, I don't. I mean, you know, that certainly would challenge everything I, you know, just in some ways, but I don't see it.
Okay.
And I don't think that's what, you know, I don't think that's what's going, I don't think that's what he's suggesting here. Okay. So, yes.
How invested do you think one has to be in this, in the chronology of the text? Are you mostly speaking about the echoes that one hears once a text is canonized?
Obviously.
If Isaiah is supposed to be heard here, then it becomes very important whether Isaiah was already written.
Yes, well, all those things. So in a, of course. You know, look, I come from a, you know, sort of postmodernist, you know, this is the text I've inherited. It's a text I love. I feel like it's all, in, you know, all that.
Really an informational enough.
But I would say to make a strong argument.
Well, this is clearly written long after Isaiah.
So I would say in, you know.
Why is that so clear?
Because by the time the Deuteronomists got through with it, Isaiah was centuries gone.
So let me just say here, let me just pull it together to say that actually, you know, in the even in the chronological dating of, I mean, obviously when texts are written, received, transmitted, I mean, these are, you know, complex, murky things. You know, chronologically, you know, in some ways, I mean, sort of in a historical chronological, in fact, you know, first Isaiah is an 8th century text. And you do have a Deuteronomic history, which is certainly, you know, 7th century, you know, into conceivably exile and whatever. So chronologically, you could say, yes, this text is very much playing. Yes. So, and I think to make an argument like this, if I was making a kind of really scholarly argument that said that, yes, this is a text playing with that text, but I think this is actually, you know, would be support for that, to say that, in fact, that text or some version of that text or that line does exist. You know, clearly there's too much similarity not to.
One more thing on that.
Yeah.
I was going to save this for later, but there's got to be something to the fact that there's a parallel text about Eliyahu which is much less complex.
Yes, I don't want to go there.
But I'm just assuming that the Eliyahu text is much earlier and that this is much later.
So you're referring to, we all know that Elijah also has his own resurrection moment. And in fact, Elisha and Elijah, these stories are, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily, you know, they don't have to necessarily be older. Elisha is obviously, I mean, in terms of composition, Elisha is obviously, and it's going to be actually, that text is, I think, also being played with, obviously. You know, is obviously Elijah's student. So, you know, it's to say, and I would say argue that he's a paler version of his teacher. And that's part of what's going on here. So, yes, I mean, you know, partly it's to read those stories in relationship to each other and see where he also, and I think it's another way of seeing Elisha falling short to his master. I want to go on a little bit. I know that I have a feeling we're not going to get to anything I want to get to, but, I mean, we're getting to it all, but, you know, and I'm just, whatever. So, just what happens next, of course, is Mayomer. And he says, Umela Sotla, what can we do for her? Says Elisha to Gehazi. Vayomer Gehazi, aval ben ein la v'isha zaken. Right? So Gehazi says, she doesn't have a son, and she has an old husband. Now, this is actually a little remarkable tidbit here, because you probably...
She's there, right?
Well, in fact, let's assume that she's not able to actually hear. I mean, you know, it makes it better in the narrative. I mean, it doesn't seem to be, because, I mean, whether she's there or not, I mean, I don't know, but she could be within...
It says right that after that, Krava.
Right, so it seems like she's not in hearing with this. I want to say, you know, it typically in the Bible, infertility is a female problem. This is the rare moment where infertility seems to be a male problem, which is just interesting to note. So that is true, but we know that Sarah is herself already labeled to be, you know, to have, and it's essentially her, you know, her problem. So that's just always interesting to note that. The other thing that I want to say, and this is where, so part of my argument is, right, that she's not going to ask for this. He should not have ordered this, right? He should not have agreed to do this. He should not have offered it. That's the better word. That only God, and I think the text is going to make this very clear, only God can control matters of life and death, not an Ish Elohim. And this is a wrong move, and ultimately this is what is going to, you know, set some negative things in motion that are going to have to be rectified. But I want to say this, which is that this story, the other interesting piece of the story is that this is a woman and a man, frankly, both of them, that do they want children? It doesn't say they do, right? And that itself is also quite interesting. And that also, to hear that in the, you know, I'm dwelling, you know, I have what I need, right? And again, back to her desire, and I'm just thinking a little bit on my feet, but, you know, there's certainly in the ancient world at large, the question of whether professional religious women had families, you know, whether female prophetesses and other kinds of diviners. You know, we know that there were priests out in the... Only Israel's really has no female priests. But it's a question to see if, you know, whether women who were those in those positions, you know, had families or did not have families. So she could actually, you know, I don't need that. I don't want that. It's not something that I'm interested in. The other individual that has a similar... And the narrative that you also have to read in conversation with this, of course, is who's another woman that sort of gets offered a child that doesn't actually ask for one. Also is not named, is Eshet Manoach. And the dynamic, and by the way, just I didn't list you the narratives that are my gender-bending stories, but Eshet Manoach is obviously one. I mean, in fact, the entire Shimshon narrative, I would argue. And Shimshon is exactly this exact same kind of dynamic of a kind of Superman that overextends himself and needs to be reined back in and is done, you know, is reined back in through women, through strong women, sort of bring him back in. And his narrative begins with this kind of inverted gender dynamic. So there's tremendous parallels to this particular story. Can I just do a little bit more then? Because do we have to end at noon?
Yeah.
Okay, so let me just, I just want to, because this is, I want you to hear this, and then I can show you a few things, and then we can have some questions or whatever. So, verse 15.
Can I just ask?
Yeah.
Do you have your notes right?
My notes?
Yeah. Do you have them? Or have you written them?
I have written, yes. I do. I do.
Okay.
I do.
It's probably a book.
It's called a manuscript.
I do. And I'm always happy to share. I actually am always happy to share. It just makes me nervous when things are in, you know, premature, as long as people accept. But if you email me, I'll give you what I have. I mean, I'm happy to share. So, verse 15, Vayomer krala v'yikrala v'ta'amod ba'petach. Always interesting. So to me, you can't have things like ta'amod lifnei. You can't have a petach. You can't have charad and not be brought, right? The sight of any, you know, again, in the ancient world, where do you have revelation? Not inside the tent, but at the tent opening. Right, so her standing and being in that sight, you know, I want to suggest is asking for something, right, specific. So she stands in the opening. She wants revelation. Vayomer lemoed hazek et chaya at choveket ben. Vatomer al adoni isha Elohim al techazeh b'shivchatecha. Vatahar ha'isha v'telet ben lemoed hazek et chaya. This is what I want to say to you. Asher diber aleha Elisha. So, she's standing at the opening, and he says, you know, this time comes around again, right? So in significant cycle, you will be hugging a son. By the way, genius vagueness, right? You will be hugging a son? What does that even mean? I mean, that's odd. Not you will give birth to a son. Chavek et ben, right? So whether that's an allusion to ultimately, you know, a different kind of hugging that is ultimately going to happen, but it's very strange. But obviously, this language brings you back to the Annunciation of Isaac itself. The only other place that we have Eid Chaya is actually in the context of Isaac's own birth narrative, right? His own Annunciation, right? This time next year, Sarah will give birth to a son, giving rise to the famous laughter scenes. Okay? But she, of course, responds, you know, in says, you know, don't, and I think this is interesting, Adoni, my lord, right, deferential, very deferential, don't, my lord, don't lie to me. Very strong language, right? Don't lie to me, right? Don't promise, and I would argue in my reading, don't promise something that you can't give, right? And lo and behold, it says that she does, in fact, concede at the appropriate time, as Elisha said to her. Okay? And I just want you to hear one thing. To me, this language here of Vateled ben lemoed hazek eid chaya asher diber aleha Elisha, in my ear, echoes to Bereishit 21:2, which is actually when, of course, Isaac is born. Right? He's actually born. And what do we have? Well, at the beginning of this, we have, this is 21:2. Leteled Sarah la'Avraham ben lizkunav la'moed asher diber oto Elohim. Right? So very similar language with this extremely different subject matter here, right? So this is coming around in, obviously, Isaac, right? Same annunciation language, but it was God who obviously does the calling and the promising, and ultimately it's God who does the fulfillment. And interestingly here, we have a human being without any request or any desire and misreading the situation, that does the offering. And we have it clear, Asher Diber Aleha Elisha, as Elisha said. And I would say for that mistake, right, the child ultimately is going to pay dearly. And then it becomes a test, you know, and it becomes, or rather, I would say a test. I mean, you could say it's sort of interesting given the Akedah language, but an exercise. That's what I would say, through which the Shunammite is able to bring him back in and teach him, right, the what he should not have done. And ultimately, you know, he's going to revive the child, but it's ultimately through God's aid, right? He's going to pray to God, and God is going to help him do that. He's not going to be able to do it on his own. And he's also clear that he's held at a distance from God. I want to show you two things. Can I show you two things, and then we can open up to questions? So, the middle of the story is just great. The exchange with the father is great, and what he's doing there is great, and how she talks to him is great. She saddles her donkey, just like the Akedah, right? She goes and searches for Elisha. She's just like Avraham, which also puts her, frankly, into a gender-bending role, because she is Avraham now in this narrative. But, of course, Avraham, not to kill, but Avraham to save.
By the way, there's another gender thing.
So tell me.
Avraham goes on a chamor, and she goes on an aton.
So actually, you know, I wrote about the distinction, but I didn't think about it as the gender. Thank you.
Yeah.
So that's great, because I wrote the distinction, but not, that's fabulous. So she grabs hold of him, and this is where I think, so in verse 27, Vatavo el Isha Elohim el Hahar, Vatachazek Baraglav, and she grabs hold of his feet. Now, this is where you have, is this subservient or not? To me, this is a question, and I'm not, I don't want to over-sexualize. I mean, I'm always happy to over-sexualize in my readings in some ways, and I think that ultimately, you know, obviously Biraglav could be, you know, at his feet and in a gesture of subservience. But just so you know where we're going, the end of the narrative, in verse 37, when she does become subservient to him, just look at it. What does she do? There, batipol aragav, she falls to his feet. Right here, she's grabbing hold, and it may be, and again, it may be subservience. But I want to suggest here, you know, there's a certain question of paternal responsibility that he has over this child. You know, effectively, he brought this child into being.
Right.
He has some kind of paternal responsibility, and she's essentially, whether she's literally or figuratively, and I would say figuratively, calling him into account, right, and saying, "You need to do this." But of course, one of the things that's still like in this give and take, she's still, you know, he's still not quite there, and he's still shoving Gehazi to her. And ultimately he says, okay, I have to do this. You know, God withheld this information to me, again, showing distance, right? God has not been open with him. But he still sends, and frankly, and we think about the phallic nature of this, with his staff, right? He sends Gehazi with his staff to revive the child. And this is what I wanted to show you. She doesn't take that. And if you look at, you know, so verse 29, he sends Gehazi, he says, you know, gird your loins, take my staff, go and don't stop to say hello to anyone, right? To which she says in verse 30, Vatomer, em hanar. And first of all, what did you just notice? For the first time, she's put in that maternal, now she's em hanar, right? Chai Adonai, you know, I swear, I will not abandon you. That, now, that's where the language of Elijah and Elisha. If you remember, when Elijah is, you know, preparing to die, it's one of the most beautiful chapters. He's, you know, he basically wants to die in peace, and Elisha won't leave him alone, right? He keeps, you know, go back, go back, go back. I don't, you know, and ultimately he agrees. But basically, Elisha keeps saying to him, I'm not going to abandon you. I'm not going to abandon you. So in some ways, she's using exactly the same language, which puts her in, one could say, in a totally subservient position. On the other hand, she's also saying, you need to follow me, right? You and I are linked. I'm not going to leave you until you come with me. And in fact, Vayakom Vayelech Achareha. And in fact, he then does. You know, I think it's at this moment that the relationship kind of, you know, sort of shifts tremendously. On the one hand, she is, you know, declaring, I will be subservient to you. You are my master, and I am, you know, at your, you know, I am second to you. And on the other hand, she's forced him now into relationship with her, and he is now following her. You know, this is, to me, a crucial moment. And, of course, he does come. And then he ultimately enters the room alone and closes the door and keeps her out of that room and performs the miracle, you know, just between him and.
Do you think his frustration there is in line with the paternity? The I mean, that's a pretty, again, talk about specificity. His fusing, that body meld with the boy. Should we be reading that sexually?
So,
in the sense of paternity, I mean that.
You know, this is obviously one of the strangest scenes we have in the entire Tanakh. I mean, you all know it, right? He climbs on top of him, mouth to mouth, right? He literally, you know, limb to limb.
Yeah, that's not how you do CPR.
And you know. So it raises interesting questions. I mean, I actually don't see it, you know, whether it's, you know, a kind of sexualized or birthing, you know, a birthing more than sexual, possible. You know, I've also been, you know, there's a certain sort of a shaman-like magic. You know, one of the things that, you know, obviously Elisha and Elijah are unique figures in the Torah. They're sort of, you know, kind of different kinds of prophets than we meet anywhere else, and they have more magical moments, if you will. And, you know, this is certainly one of them. And people have suggested there's kind of contact magic, right? That the sense of, you know, that there's physical touching of the prophet has obviously, you know, transmits some kind of power. And that's obviously going on here, but that it's more of the, you know, I mean, I think
yeah,
that conceivably.
That makes good sense to me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. But at the end of the narrative, ultimately, you know, he revives the child, he brings the child, he unites the mother and son, and of course the order between Elisha and the Shunammite is restored to its proper order, and we have her Vatipol Araglav, Batishtachu, and she, you know, bows down to the ground. And then, Matisad Banavatesa, and she lifts up the child and she walks away. And you can see that, you know, in the coda, which you can look at yourselves, you can see how, even in what happens next, that hierarchy remains. And Elisha, you know, cares for the Shunammite and is still, you know, remains in that kind of hierarchical protective role over her as they go forward. So, yes, I can. Questions, comments.
Just quickly, really about Gehazi. Is his role here more to show the power of Elisha, in the sense that, right, this woman won't share with him what's wrong, but she's not even telling him that my son is dead, but my son is not breathing. Is only having a conversation with Elisha. Is only when he tries to use the staff, you know, that which should have. The well, magical prophetic powers of Elisha, it does nothing. It's to distinguish that he himself, as an Ish Elohim, is unique.
So that's a great reading. I mean, my reading obviously is not that. My reading is that he's there in some ways to show the impotence, you know, that Elisha just doesn't quite get how to do this. And he's there to kind of illustrate that.
Exactly.
And she, again, her forcefulness, her direction, you know, she wants to engage directly with the prophet. At the beginning, she wants something, I think, you know, wants some of his status. In the end, she just wants to make sure that he does his job, right? She no longer, in some ways, I guess my argument is that she doesn't really aspire to that holy status in the end. She goes back to, you know, she assumes the proper position. She's just the, you know, Isha Gedolah in the end. But in my reading, he's there as a sort of indicator of how ineffective Elisha is.
She's no longer an Isha Gedolah. She's now a mother.
And now she's just a right. That's how I would say it.
Wow. Thank you.
Wow.